listener production.
This is Crappy to Happy, and I am your host, Cass Dunn. I'm a clinical and coaching psychologist, a mindfulness meditation teacher, and of course, author of the Crappy to Happy books. In this show, I bring you conversations with interesting, inspiring, intelligent people who are experts in their field and who have something of value to share that will help you feel less crappy and more happy. I can't believe it has taken me this long to have Hugh Van Sylenberg on the podcast, but once we got talking, we could have talked for hours. You might know Hugh from his book, The Resilience Project, or his podcast, The Imperfects. Hugh has been banging on about the benefits of gratitude, empathy, and mindfulness for the longest time. He became a school teacher initially after watching his sister struggle with her mental health, thinking that if he could help kids with their mental health, then they would hopefully grow up to be happy adults. He has since gone on to create the Resilience Project, where he teaches mental health skills to kids across the country. That program is now also in big sporting clubs all around the country, including AFL clubs, the National Rugby League, and the Australian cricket team. And as I said, Hugh now also hosts his very own popular podcast called The Imperfects, where he gets seemingly perfect, very well-known Australians like Hamish Blake, to talk about all of their insecurities and share their vulnerability. In our chat, Hugh shared with me what it was like growing up with a sister who struggled with mental health issues, the challenges that he has had getting his work into schools, as well as the success that he has had, and the personal crisis that he had during lockdown, which led to him writing his most recent book, which is called Let Go. This is a really special conversation. I hope that you love it. Here's Hugh. Morning, Hugh. Welcome to the Crappy to Happy podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, as my phone beeps at the worst possible time.
Good reminder to
turn it on.
Turn off our phones. I know. I better put mine on silent too. I normally do that and I get a bit slack sometimes. Hugh, I was just saying to you earlier that I feel like everybody knows who you are from the amazing book that you wrote, The Resilience Project, and the work that you do. And you do have another book out more recently. I feel like I'm the only person in Australia who hasn't had you on the show to talk about the Resilience Project. It's very remiss of me. So can we start there? Can you please tell me about the Resilience Project and how that came about?
Yeah, happily. And thanks for having me on, by the way. I really love this podcast. I most recently listened to the episode with, is it Mosher? Is that right?
Yes, Mind Wandering. Yes.
Yeah, I'd read a similar book. It was a little bit on mind wandering and it completely blew my mind. And then I listened to that episode and you have amazing conversations. They're so good. So thanks for having me on. It's a real thrill.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And thank you for saying, I find that fascinating too. We could have a whole separate conversation about Mosher and why I'm wondering, but let's talk about you today, Hugh.
What was the question? I forgot the question.
Tell me about the Resilience Project. How did it come to be right from the beginning?
Yeah. Well, I guess some people will be thinking, I've heard this story before, but I might try and tell it in a little bit of a different way, in a way that I haven't really told before. But we, growing up as kids, we had a very, very happy childhood, very blessed. In fact, my wife and I last night, we went out for dinner and a movie, which we never, ever, ever, ever get to do. And I, for some really weird reason, chose the suburb that I grew up in. Like I said, we should go there. And it's not close to home. I was like, I'd like to go there. And she said, "What? It's a bit of a daggy place." She said, "Why are we going there? We could go here or here." And I said, I actually don't know. I just really want to go there. And we ended up in the suburb of Bourne, in Melbourne, and we went to a movie. And I was sitting there and I was sitting there last night and I said to her, I think the reason I want to come here is I just have the most amazing memories of my childhood. I was so lucky, a big backyard and very present parents and went to good schools and loved playing sport in the backyard and these beautiful memories of, you know, in the winter sliding around in the grass, pretending I was an AFL footballer, and in summer it was playing cricket until it got dark and getting bitten by mosquitoes and begging Dad to keep playing. And so you had a really happy childhood. When my sister was 14 and I was 17, she was diagnosed with anorexia nervosa. So Mum and Dad sat me down when I was 17 and my sister was 14. My little brother Josh was 11 at the time. And they said, "Your sister's not well." And I think she'd played netball that day. I said, "Netball?" "Yeah, it was netball." And I said, "What are you talking about? She's fine." I said, "No, she's sick." And I said, "She played netball today. She's definitely not sick." And they said, no, no, your sister's got a mental illness, not a physical illness. And I said, ah, right. And I said, do you understand? And I said, no. I said that we were not talking about mental illness in the 90s at schools or really anywhere. I don't, not that I'm aware of, but definitely in my world, it was not a thing that was ever talked about. I had no idea what they were talking about. And they explained that when she eats food, she'll get better. And I thought, okay, that does not sound serious at all. Like, if she just has to eat food, that is not a serious, like, that's far from serious. And it got worse and worse and worse. And it just was so grim in our household. And I remember the day my sister was admitted to hospital, coming home from the hospital, and she was 18 and I was 20, 21. And I remember sitting at the dinner table and we were having dinner. It was just sisters in the hospital. It was me, mum, dad, and my brother, Josh. And dad got up really early. Like, he hadn't finished his dinner, but he just got up and went and stood at the kitchen sink. And I thought he was just doing the washing up. And I asked him something. He didn't answer. And I asked him again. I turned around and I looked at him and he was, I'll never ever forget this. It still makes me really emotional even thinking of it. But I'll never forget the very sad figure, this silhouette of my dad standing over the kitchen sink just sobbing. And I had only ever seen dad cry once before that, when our dog died. It was like literally 10 years before that. I'd never seen dad cry apart from that. And I think that was kind of the moment a lot of things happened for me. First of all, that's when I realized how serious this mental illness was. I mean, I think I knew deep down, but I was sort of ignoring it. I was pretending it wasn't happening because I just didn't know how to deal with something so painful. So I just, like a lot of men, I went, no, I think I'll just not focus on that. I'll pretend it's not happening. So I kind of ignored it. And but when I saw dad crying, two things happened. I realized how serious it was. But the second thing that happened was I became deeply fascinated in the question, what is it that makes people happy? I knew I couldn't go into the hospital and fix my sister. I knew that was well beyond me, but I did want to help. I just remember thinking, my mum and dad are not happy. My brother's not happy. I want to help them to be happier. And I had no idea, absolutely no idea what to do or how I would achieve that. I very soon after that, I changed my, I was actually studying at the time neuropsychophysiology, which is a course I couldn't even spell, so I was never going to pass it. I just had this desire to be in schools, and so I quit that course, which is such a huge mistake. I wish I'd kept going. I would have loved to have. But I went into teaching because I had this sort of, if I go to schools and I'm a teacher, then I can stop kids getting a mental illness. And I had no plan on how I was going to do that. In fact, my first job was at a girls' school because I remember thinking, oh, there'll be heaps of kids there that could potentially be like my sister, so I'll go there. I remember my first day in the classroom, like going, okay, let's stop these kids getting a mental illness. I don't know how. I have absolutely no idea how I'm going to do this, but I remember having that strong feeling when I was in the, I wasn't thinking about literacy or numeracy, or there are 11-year-old girls, and I was sitting there going, I'm going to make these kids the happiest kids in the world. And yeah, we had a lot of fun, but I had no idea what I was doing, and it probably wasn't until I was in, I mean, my sister was still sick the whole way through this whole journey of my teaching, and my partner at the time, she was also a school teacher. We met at university. Her name is Anjali. She's an amazing teacher, incredible person. And I was so blessed to meet her at uni and spend our time together at uni. And she said to me, I want to go, and we were living together at the time, and she said, I want to go and live. I want to go overseas somewhere. And I didn't want to because I was such a homebody, and I wanted to stay in Bourne and go to the cinema and all that kind of stuff. And she was desperate too. So we ended up going overseas, and we chose India because her dad is Indian, so we thought we'll go to India. And when we were over there, I said, let's do some teaching so we can get paid. And so we needed to earn some money. And she said, I think we should volunteer. And I said, it's teaching. It's the same thing. We might as well get paid for it. And she's just got such a beautiful spirit and such a generous, compassionate person. She said, no, we're over here. We're going to go, and we've seen people who need teachers over here, like desperately need, let's go and volunteer. And I sort of agreed to it. And when a community said, you can live here you can live with the principal for a couple of weeks and you'll get three meals a day, I thought, oh, that's terrific. You know, we're on a shoestring budget. I wasn't being a tight ass. We were on a shoestring budget. So we kind of had to, I was considering that, where she's just got this really philanthropic nature about it. She was thinking, I don't really care. Let's just volunteer. I'll never forget the feeling of shock that I felt when we arrived in this village and we were being shown around, and I realized in this village there was no running water. There was no electricity. We were sleeping on the floor. There were no beds. And I remember thinking very early on, I can't do this. I actually can't do this. There's no way I'm staying a few weeks here. There's just, it's not, I can't do it. I would love to, but I just can't. She on the other hand was thinking, no, this is perfect. This is what, this is going to be good for us. And I was thinking, how's sleeping on a floor going to be good for us? My first day in the school changed my life forever because I just met these kids, one kid in particular who I write about in the book a lot called Stunzen. I remember this kid, the impact he had on me. I just remember thinking to myself, I've never in my life seen joy like this before. I've never seen joy like it. And I remember thinking, I remember looking across the, we're in the middle of the desert. The classrooms were, there was a blackboard in every classroom, one piece of chalk. There was a stick which had cotton wrapped around it or like some kind of material that you would use to rub off the board. It didn't really work properly. So there was just, it looked like hundreds of years worth of like writing in the background. You had to write over the top of it. Kids sitting on the floor. They've got their school uniform. As far as I could see, that was pretty much all they owned for clothes, their school uniform. Shoes that were just, I mean, if we saw a kid wearing their shoes in a school in Australia, we'd be really concerned, you know, but all the kids had these old shoes that are too small for them. And I just remember thinking to myself, I've never seen joy like this. And I became very fascinated by that. And it's easy to join the dots on your journey looking back. I don't think at any point I thought, well, I need to experience this so I can then go back to Australia and set up this thing. But I think my sister's struggles back home inspired me to go, do you know what? I'm going to live here as long as it takes me to work out. What are these people doing every single day that just makes them so happy? So we stayed for 3.5 months. And in all the podcasts I've done and all the stories I've done, I soon after we got back from India, my ex and I, we actually broke up. And so soon after that, I went and started telling the story about going to India. So, and I cut her out of the story purely because I found it very hard to talk about it. It was just, I didn't want to break up. So, right. So I was like, I didn't want to turn up to schools every day and talk about someone that I sort of still wanted in my life. So, but we've recently got back in touch, as in literally in the last like few months, and it's been really nice. And so I feel like I've never really given her credit for the fact that I went there because of her, and we went to that village because of her, and we stayed as long as we did because of her. I've never given her the credit for that, and I feel like I need to. But when we were there and when I was there, I just remember this one kid in particular called Stunzen. And if people Google me, I think you don't have to scroll too far to find a photo of this kid Stunzen, because I talk about him wherever I go. He just did these things every single day because they're running the village. What they did was they practiced gratitude, empathy, and mindfulness, which is on the front cover of the book, so it's not a huge surprise to anyone. But they just practice these things every single day. And I could have sort of joined in just because it was weird if we didn't. You know, they'd do this meditative chant every single morning for like half an hour. And I remember thinking, this is a ridiculous waste of time. But it wasn't until I came back to Australia and looked into the research behind these things. And you would know this being a psych, but there is decades and decades and decades of research screaming at us that these things, gratitude, empathy, and mindfulness, they're not the silver bullet that just make you happy and stop you having a mental illness ever. But what they do is they push you up the mental health spectrum. You know, as your podcast would say, they can take you from crappy to happy pretty quickly. And so this is such a long answer to your question. Sorry, Kat.
No, I love it.
But that's kind of how the Resilience Project started. I came back to Melbourne and I went back to teaching, and I had a group of about 30 kids that I was teaching, and I started bringing gratitude, empathy, and mindfulness into my own classroom. I didn't tell anyone at the school I was doing it because I was worried they'd say, no, don't do that. And I think they probably would have going back, because I was like, you're not here to teach them that. It's literacy, numeracy.
So what sort of, when was this, like, is this back in the early 2000s?
In India, it was 2008.
Right.
And 2009, I was back. And 10, I was back teaching in a classroom. I had a group of kids who are disengaged from traditional schooling. So it was the opposite of a private girls' school, which I mentioned before. It was a group of teenage boys who were really struggling in mainstream school, were a bit lost. And so I had these boys, and I would start the morning every morning with this 20-minute walk around this huge park, and all they're allowed to do is think about what they could hear. And then I have to come back and write down the things they could hear. I couldn't really get them to sit still and do a meditation, but they would do that because they were very kind of like tactile or didactic, or they just loved movement. And so we would do that. End of the day, they had to just write on a piece of paper on the desk three things that went well for them during the day. And they didn't have to call it out or say it. They just had to leave it there so I could see. So that was the gratitude stuff. And we had this rolling, we called it a rolling act of kindness, where no one knew who was on at that time. Someone had to start it and they would do something kind for someone else. And then that person, it was onto them. Then they'd pass it on to someone else. And so we were doing stuff like that. And I just noticed it just had this a huge impact on these boys who, I don't know, I didn't measure it. There was no research on it. I just felt like in my heart, I just felt like it was really big for these boys and did it with this. The next year I had a group of boys, a few girls in the class, well, did it again and it just seemed to be really big for them as well. And then I remember thinking, I want to reach more people with this stuff. I think I'm going to go and do talks at a school. And so I quit my job as a teacher. I remember telling the people I was quitting and they said, oh, you're starting your own business. And this is how green I was. I really had no idea what I was doing. I said, no, I'm not starting a business. I'm just going to go and do talks at a school. And they said, well, what school? And I said, I don't know. I called my old school where I went to school and I said, you would love to have you come back and speak. They said, oh, how much does it cost? And I went, it's $149. And so they went, what, to speak for an hour for the whole year level? And I went, yep. And they went, wow, okay, yeah, that's great. I remember thinking, wow, that's pretty cool, $150 for an hour. This is unbelievable. I was like, I'm going to be loaded. This is just ridiculous. And then I called the school where I taught and I told them and they went, yeah, no worries, how much? I said, $140. I went, oh, my gosh. I was thinking, this is like, I'm making so much money here. This is outrageous. And then I started calling schools who'd never heard of me and people were going, sorry, mate, who are you? And I was like trying to explain and they went, yeah, no, we'll be fine. Thanks very much. Where have you done this before? And I said, oh, this school and this school. And they went, so just two schools, the school you went to and the school you taught at. And I was like, yeah, but they loved it. And people go, well, just come back to us next year. And it was 3 years of seriously lonely and a lot of no's, like a lot of no's. I remember sitting at one of the most exclusive private schools in Melbourne and with the assistant principal, one of the most, maybe the most exclusive. And I was sitting in there and I was looking out the window and there were four gardeners working on the same hedge. And I remember the guy said to me, sorry, mate, we don't have money in the budget for that. And I was thinking, oh, could you get one of the gardeners to stay at home for the morning or whatever? But I look back and what I was offering back then, you know, it was a presentation, that's it. But now it's, you know, we now got, I think it's about 420,000 kids around Australia doing our curriculum every single day and tuning into our digital program, which we created with, you know, half of Hamish and Andy's team. And
it's amazing. But you were ahead of your time. All that stuff that everybody's talking about now, like back then, you know, I was in the field and it was pretty new.
Yeah.
All even that positive psychology and all the benefits of it and focusing on strengths and, you know, that wasn't widely talked about.
Yeah, it's very true. I remember people would say, oh, so this is positive psychology. And I was very careful to say, I said not really. I said it's some elements of positive psychology. I know the people who do positive psychology are pretty like, this is our thing and don't do it
right.
If you're not us. Which is fine. But I for a while people were saying you need to study positive psychology, you need to do it, you need to go back to uni and study it. And I thought, I understand why people are saying this, but what I do is I go and tell really emotional or highly, I hope, what are emotionally engaging stories based off my life. And what I saw was gratitude, empathy, and mindfulness. And these are the things that I think have saved my sister's life as well, by the way. And I don't want to get up on stage and say, here are some things that other people have researched that, well, sorry, I do that with gratitude, empathy, and mindfulness, but people are saying, you need to be talking about mindset. You're not talking about mindset. And I would say a mindset is amazing. Like a growth mindset is, it's incredible, but I don't have an emotional story that is going to engage an audience to link to that. It would literally be saying, oh, also there's this thing called growth mindset. And when you've got a growth mindset, to me, that's not what we do at Resilience Projects. Like we have these beautiful stories of these kids in India who literally would point out to me every single day how lucky they were to have shoes or to have a school uniform or to have lunch provided for them or is rice. And I didn't have stories about kids in India going, also, I have a growth mindset, so yeah. You might want to talk about that. So I just felt like for this to work, if I'm going to go to schools and talk, it needs to be really authentic experience to me in my life, and that's kind of what's worked for us. And so it's funny you mentioned positive psychology because early on, you know, people from Geelong Grammar in particular were saying, well, it's not positive psychology. If you want to do positive psychology, you need to come and train with us and we'll teach you. And then you can, which I was very grateful for, and that's fine. But I didn't have an emotional connection to a lot of the stuff that they were teaching. And so I thought, no, I need to be authentic to me and my experience and do this in a way that works for me. And which has been amazing. We had this, we haven't really started talking about this publicly yet, Casper. We had this, and this will interest you enormously, but and I bring this up now just because I think some people were thinking, if it's not positive psychology, it's probably not going to work. You can't just use elements of it and hope. But we had a researcher from Adelaide University, or a research team a few years ago, heard that we were in 1,000 schools. And I think they thought, is anyone going to evaluate this program, or is this just going to, are we just all going to just jump into this? And so they actually did an evaluation of it, which made me quite nervous at the time because we get great anecdotal feedback. But I was worried they were going to publish this thing saying, it doesn't work. And so what they did was they looked at 80,000 kids in Australia who are not doing our program and compared with 80,000 kids that are doing our program. And yeah, and it was kind of like, it was a huge sample size. And I never, when they gave me the results, I didn't know if I should be happy or sad. I still haven't worked it out. What they found was the 80,000 kids around Australia not doing our program in the year 2019, 2020, 2021, symptoms of anxiety, depression went up greatly, and their feelings of hope and life satisfaction went down, which is not a huge surprise, I don't think, of what we've just been through or we're going through. But what they found was the kids who are at Resilience Project schools, their depression and anxiety didn't go up at all, and their life satisfaction and feelings of hope actually went up in 2020, which I saw that and I felt this great pang of like pride or excitement. But then I thought, oh my God, we're only in 1,000 schools. There's a lot more schools in Australia and so it was this mixed kind of feeling. But you know, it was a nice validation, I guess, for what we do.
Totally. And I guess, you know, and the evidence there to be able to go to schools and say, this is why you need it. Now you've got something tangible that you can say. It's not just anecdotal.
Here's the evidence. Yeah, it is nice to be able to present this stuff to prospective schools and say, oh, by the way, it works.
I love that you stayed authentic and in integrity with yourself and you tell stories, because that is obviously what connects with people and what engages people. And being a psychologist myself, I think there is a real, it's double-edged. Like, I was really keen to go and get my my registration as a psychologist, even when I was life coaching, because I wanted that credibility. You know, I wanted to be able to say, like, I'm qualified to talk about this stuff. But there's this, and I think many psychs will relate to this, once you've got the qualification, you kind of become there's a sense of restriction or constriction about what you can talk about, because you can't just share an opinion. Everything that you say has got to be backed up by evidence, because you're a psychologist and you've got to maintain this ethical standards, and, you know, it's got to be, you know, you get conditioned into having to have 25 references to back up everything that you say. Like, it's irresponsible to just throw an opinion or something, an anecdote out there.
I know exactly what you're saying. It's such a tight line that you sort of have to, podcast, The Imperfects, we've got a psychologist on once a month who will pick out her favourite part of an episode and then talk about it. And I've known Emily for a very, 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 very long time, since we were kids. And I was saying, I'm so excited you're doing this. But every episode we are so restricted by, she'll say something and say, actually, can we edit that out? I actually probably can't say that as I'm not your psychologist. I'm not giving, because we'll talk about things and issues in our life, and she'll say, okay, so I'm not your psychologist, so I can't, this is not advice. This is a theory
right,
that
you're
I,
not allowed to do that.
It's so
you're
funny. Not allowed to do that. Exactly. And then we'll turn the microphone off and she'll say, oh, I read this amazing thing. And she'll tell me something unbelievable. And I'll go, we should say that. And she goes, oh, I can't say that because of this, this, and this. So it's a really interesting space you're in. And it's something I'm very aware of, as well as someone who talks about mental health who doesn't have the education and the qualifications that you do. I'm petrified of saying something that's going to cause harm, or someone's going to go, oh, it's clinical advice. I'm not a psychologist. I'm fascinated by the topic, and I read a lot and I listen to a lot of people like yourself, so psychologists, and I'll pass on what you guys say. But even that makes me nervous. So, I understand exactly.
I hope that you're enjoying this conversation and realizing the benefits of positivity in your own life. If you are enjoying the show, please be sure to like and subscribe so that you get notified when new eps drop, and head on over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a rating and review. How did this become, like, you talking to a couple of schools to becoming, okay, so away from schools. Now you're in sporting clubs. You're telling me off air that you were just with the State of Origin team. How has it developed, Hugh?
It's been an extraordinary journey and exhausting, because I, for 3 years, no one said yes. So when people started saying yes, I just said yes to everything and everyone. And I was like, I'm not going to say no. I will not say no. And I was stupid because some of the stuff I did was just ridiculous. I was being burned out quite a few times, but it just word of mouth. I never did advertising. I never did marketing. I probably should have in the first 3 years, but I remember thinking, I just want this to be word of mouth. I feel like that's the most powerful way, most authentic way to grow this. I'm a huge fan of the band The National, and I remember reading an article about them saying they're the last rock band to grow organically and authentically without social media, without in this new age of like things going viral. It was just their music. You know, they'd play gigs every single night. There's footage of them playing gigs where there's like one person there and they are giving it everything. There's footage of them going on stage and there's no one there at a gig, and they gave it everything because the guy who was doing the sound was really enjoying it and he told a mate, and that had a big impact on me. And I thought, just whenever you get on stage, give it absolutely everything you have, because one person might tell another teacher and they might say, you should get this guy in your school. And then that was my attitude and my approach. And it just took off. At a certain point, it took off. I remember having thoughts 3 years in, I'm done. I feel so lonely. Like I'm by myself doing this and no one's interested. And I was outside of school about to go into emergency teaching, and I got a phone call from a lady, I wish I remembered her name, and she said, I don't know anything about you. My friend just gave me your number. I'm at a conference with 50 principals. The keynote speaker hasn't turned up. Can you be here in an hour? I said, I could be there in an hour and a half. And she said, that'll do. Drive as quick as you can, please. And I went into the school and said, I'm so sorry, I can't come today. And they went, what do you mean, you're here? And I said, no, I'm sorry. And they said, you're never welcome back, which was fair enough. And I got in the car and drove to this conference, and I had no schools on the books at that point. I'd exhausted my contacts, and I remember thinking to myself, well, this is kind of make or break. And it was just one of those, I mean, I've heard you speak about flow before, but it was just like that. I got up there and it just flowed beautifully. And my phone was buzzing in my back pocket heaps, and I was thinking, gosh, this is so distracting. It was principals sending me emails as I was speaking to book me in.
Wow.
And we booked in 48. I booked in 48 schools out of the 50 principals in the next week. And all of a sudden it just took off as a school program. And I remember, how did it get to sport? It's an amazing story. I was playing cricket. Played cricket my entire life, and I was a captain of my side, and a guy came up to me, one of the new players' dads, and he introduced himself, and he was a lovely bloke. We're having a chat. He asked what I did, and I said, I talk about resilience in schools. He said, oh, our workplace could do with that. And I said, all right. And he said, would you like to come speak at my workplace? I said, where do you work? And he said, at the Melbourne Storm. And there was the rugby league team. And I thought he meant like the staff there. And I said, yeah, no worries, send me an email during the week, we'll see. And he emailed me and said, oh, it's the playing group. I want the playing group to listen to you speak. I'm head of wellbeing at the Melbourne Storm. And I said, look, this is a school program. I don't know if it's going to work for those boys. And he said, oh, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work, but at least we're going to try it. And I took a bit of convincing because I was thinking, I didn't feel qualified. I was like, I'm not qualified to. And then I said it to him and he said, didn't you tell me you tell stories about your life? And I said, yeah. He said, who's better qualified than you to tell stories about your life? And right. I said, okay, we'll give it a go. And I remember, I was 5 minutes in and Billy Slater, of all people, stopped me. He said, he put his hand up and I said, yes, Mr. Slater. And he said, can I swear on this podcast? I haven't checked, sorry.
Yeah.
You beep it out if you need to. But he said, this is fucking awesome. Keep going. And I went, oh, well, I wasn't going to stop, but thank you. And I remember at that point, I actually took a breath for the first time 5 minutes in because I was so nervous and so sort of on edge. And I actually looked around at the boys' faces and I remember going, wow, this is really hitting home. Like, this is, I've got them. This is like, more than I've ever seen before. And I finished the session, and then this guy, Brian Phelan, the wellbeing officer, got up and said, "Hope you enjoyed that, guys. Let's chat about what we're going to do about this. We can chat about it." And one of the players said, "Can you, like, when's he coming back?" And I was still there at the time, and I said, "Oh, I'm happy to come back and speak." And they said, "Yeah, let's book it again this time next." So I did another one next week. But when I was there the next week, the head of the NRL's wellbeing, a lovely guy called Paul Heppenstall, was there. And I didn't know who he was at the time, but I did the talk, and he came up to me and he said, "I want you to go to every club in the competition, and I want you to do seven. I want you to speak to the playing group, to their partners, to the head office from every club, to the under 20s, the under 18s, under 16s. So six talks at every club. Can you do that?" And I couldn't. I was exhausted at that point from the school's work, but I said, "Yep, no worries." And I spent the next 6 months, nearly killed myself, going to every club. But at that point then, it was, there were a few stories came out. One of the boys, and I wrote about this in the first book, one of the boys, his name's Martin Kennedy, played for the Roosters. He, when I was speaking to the Roosters players, he had his head down, arms folded, pulled his hoodie over his head. And I remember thinking, "I don't know who this guy is, but he hates this." And he walked out. As soon as the session finished, players usually hang around to have a chat. He just walked straight off, and I thought, he's hating this. But I'll never forget that. I remember thinking he's kind of a scary-looking guy. So for some reason, his face, I just, every now and again, he'd look up, and he should have looked angry, and he'd put his head down again. And about a year later, I did a talk in Sydney. It was just a public one at I can't remember the venue, but it was open to the public, and there was about probably 1,000 people there, maybe a little bit more than that. And I saw him walk in just before I started. No, just as I was starting, he walked in with it looked like his mum. And I thought, well, that's weird. And I saw a few people had noticed him because he's quite a well-known person in Sydney. And I finished the show, I finished the talk, and I was calling them talks back then. I call them a show now because it's a lot more than just a talk now. But I finished the talk, and every other crowd said I left, and he was hanging around. I saw him hanging around. And so I came out, and he came up to me, and his mum was patting him on the back, and she said, "Tell him." And he went to talk, and he couldn't. He just started crying, and he stopped, and he put his head down. And I said, "Is everything all right?" And she said, "That's okay. Maybe we'll get a touch another way." And he walked out, and I left the venue, and he was still out in the front about 20 minutes later. And he came up to me with his mum, and he said, "I want you to know that your talk." He said, when I turned up to footy that day, I had made plans to end my life. I had got everything I needed. It was in the back of my car. And I was on the way to mum and dad's place down the beach. They weren't home for the weekend, and I was going to take my life." And his mum bawling her eyes out. And he said, "But because of the talk you gave, I'm still here. And I want you to know that." And he gave me a massive hug. And his mum gave me a massive hug. And I just, stories started coming out like that. And then it gained a bit of publicity. And then it just, then it was the Australian cricket team. Then it was AFL clubs. And it was.
Yeah, wow.
Olympics, Australian Olympic team. And all of a sudden it was just this thing that just, it was sort of too big for me to handle, to be honest. It was kind of, and I started to struggle. And that's what the next book, Let Go, was about. I really started to struggle because I was being everything for everyone, and I was running around. I remember mum said to me once, mum was hated how much I was just taking off all the time. And I had our 5-year-old was, you know, when he was 1 or 2 years old, I was interstate all the time. And I wanted to be home with my son. That's all I've ever wanted to do, is to be a dad. But I'd booked in all those talks a year before he was born. So I was like, well, I have to go. And I remember saying to mum once, mum had come over to look after Benji, and I was leaving, bags were packed, and I was running late for the airport. I was stressed, like, "See you, buddy, see you, mum, see you, Penny," and my wife. And mum said, she just shook her head. It was such a disapproving look. And I said, "Mum, these people, they really need me. Like, they really need this. I've been told they need someone to look after them for this." And she said, "And who's looking after you?" And I went,
"Mum's no."
And I was like, "Well, that's." At the time, I kind of brushed it off at the time, but I looked back at it, and "Mum's no." You're right, "Mum's no."
I want to talk about what happened next, Hugh. But before I do, I just want to pick up on something you said before about, you said for 3 years you said yes to everything, and you said I was so stupid because I burnt myself out, and I just think that you weren't so stupid. That's what everybody does. Well, people who want to be successful, people who feel passionately about what they do say yes to everything. And I think that's a personal, you get to a point where you start to learn to say no.
Yeah.
And I got this is a bit of a digression. I've got a bit of a personal beef with people who say, let me give you the shortcut so that you don't make all the same mistakes that I made. And I think, no, every one of us has got to make our own mistakes and learn those lessons for ourselves. Wouldn't you agree? Yeah. Like you got it. When people say, no, this is what I did, and this is the mistakes I made, and this is what I, let me shortcut your road. I'll tell you, no, like it doesn't happen. Every one of us has got to learn those lessons for ourselves about saying no, boundaries, et cetera.
It's a really, really nice point. And I've never thought about that, but it's actually very true. I had lunch with a guy yesterday who is wanting to do a similar thing basically he wants to do something very similar to what I'm doing. And he just wanted to pick my brain on it. I actually found myself not saying stuff like, make sure you don't burn yourself out, make sure you don't. And it was subconsciously, but I think I was clearly thinking what you were thinking. Like, I think he's going to make a lot of mistakes, but.
Yeah. But that's his road, right?
Yeah.
We all have to.
You don't learn as much from a guy saying, don't say, like, you know, I think you need to go through that point of like, I was twiddling my thumbs for 3 years. So I was like, well, I'm not going to say no. And it's funny now as a 42-year-old, I am just now learning to say no to people. And gosh, it's good. I'm really like, it's been good for me, but it's taken a long time to get to that point. But I only arrived at it through making the mistakes, as you said. So I'm glad no one stopped me. People tried to stop me, but I was like, no, I'm fine.
And when you said it, I've done the same thing. So I was hearing your story going, yep, I totally relate to that. I've done exactly the same thing. Like I've had to get there myself and nobody could have told me, like, no, start saying no when you're in it and you're doing it, you get there.
Yeah, yeah.
So Hugh, at the start of the pandemic, you've got a much bigger following than what I do, but even myself, having written a book called Crappy to Happy, having a podcast called Crappy to Happy, the requests and the emails started coming in. Can we talk about how do we handle this thing we've never handled before, the pandemic, the anxiety, the toilet paper shortage, like what's going on? And everybody starts wanting you to help them through this thing that none of us have done before.
Yeah.
And you know, for me at the time, and I know you can relate to this, it was like, well, fuck, I've never been through a pandemic before. Like I can tell you what I can tell you what some of the science says. I can tell you what I think was going on with this. And I did 3 solo episodes of this podcast called Coping with COVID, like just 3 sort of short episodes of covering some of these topics. And they're the most downloaded episodes of all time.
Really? Wow.
So they were really needed. Like people were really looking for help at that time. So you were in the same boat. So talk me through what happened for you.
I did the whole like, yep, I'm happy to do it, happy to chat there. And it was radio interview after, like just like you, like interviews. And there were some warning signs along the way that potentially I wasn't coping. I remember my daughter was 8 months old at the time because she was born February 2020. And she was 8 months old and she wasn't sleeping. She still doesn't sleep very well. And she was sick. She had a runny nose and she had a really blocked nose and she was unwell. So she wasn't sleeping. And I remember lying on the floor in her bedroom I got really angry at her. I was saying, just sleep. This is just ridiculous. Go to sleep. And I got really angry at her. And the next morning I woke up and I was like, how did I just get angry at an 8-month-old who's sick? Like that is not, I've never been angry at anyone in my entire life. And now I'm angry at my 8-month-old daughter. I remember thinking I was so disappointed in myself. And then about probably a week later, I did an interview on Ed Cavalier and Dave Hughes' radio show. And the interview finished and Dave Hughes lives in Sydney, but his family is in Melbourne when he's doing this, the radio show. So he knew that people in Melbourne do it tough. And he finished the interview by saying, hey, just quickly checking, how are you? How are you going? And I said, I'll never forget this. I was sitting in the cupboard at home to get away from the kids so I could get some space. I'm sitting in the cupboard so it was dark.
I've done that too.
Podcasting
from the cupboard, yeah.
Yes, yeah, exactly. I was scrunched up in a ball in this cupboard with Penny's like clothes all over my head, which is great for sound apparently. It was actually really good.
Yeah, that's exactly right, yeah.
So I'm hiding in Penny's dresses, which sounds a bit weird, and I had my phone up and he said, how are you going? And I said, I'm totally and utterly broken. And as I said that, I covered my mouth and I went, oh, fuck, what have I just said? I'm meant to be the guy. What have I just said? And I had this, and then they went quiet for me and said, oh, okay. Hope you're going okay, mate. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time, blah, blah, blah. And I sat there going, oh, God, what have I just said? Hang on. I haven't even admitted that to myself yet. Why have I just said that to tens of thousands of people in Sydney? And I came out of the closet. I came out of the closet and I went down the hallway and I, Penny, like trying to manage the breakfast and the kids. And she said, "How'd you go?" And I said, "I'm not good." She said, "What do you mean?" I said, "I'm not coping with this. I'm not coping. I'm not in a good place." And she said, "You okay?" And I was like crying. I was like, "I'm not. I just told Dave Hughes, of all people, that I'm not
told coping." Australia, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And but the second I told her, I was flooded with this. You might be able to tell me what this is. I don't know if it's oxytocin. I don't know what it is, but I was flooded with this warm. I went from crappy to happy. I just felt really this positive. Yeah, like, I just felt really good. And I, all of a sudden, I sat back in that for the rest of the day and two things happened. I became really curious as to what I could, I was humbled. I felt very humble. This humility of like, I'm not coping. Cool. I've just said it. I'm not coping. I'm not good. And I felt humble. And then I felt really curious later that day. Okay, what do I need to do? That sent me on this path to seeing a psychologist for the first time in my life. Even though I've been telling everyone for the last 10 years, see a psychologist, they're the best things in the world. And people go, are you? I'm like, yeah, I will get around to it, definitely. But I started seeing one and it was just so life-changing. And I just, every session I had with her, it was like the same thing. She kept saying to me, you need to let go of something. You need to let go of this. And that's why the next book was called Let Go, because every session it was like, you need to let go of your expectation to always feel happy. You need to let go of your ego that you are going to have the answers all the time. You need to let go of, you know, so every time it's just like it's perfection. You want to be perfect. You want to do perfect talks all the time. You know, when people criticize you, that's okay. Like, let go of that. That's totally fine. I'm like, no, but I'm trying my hardest and it comes from a good place. Why are people criticizing me? And that's because you want to be perfect. Just let go of that. And that's how it was an amazing revelation for me. And if it wasn't for the pandemic, I wouldn't have had. Penguin was saying to me, when's the next book? I was like, I don't have another book. I've written everything. Gratitude, empathy, mindfulness. That's all I've got for you. But it was because of my struggles that the second book came about, I guess.
I'm assuming, though, that the practice that you already had, like the gratitude and the empathy and the mindfulness, well, mindfulness in particular, must have really put you in a good place so that when that crunch point came, like you said, I was able to stop and stand back and get a bit curious about that. Like instead of just plowing on through, which somebody else may do who doesn't have that foundation of mindfulness and I guess just that self-awareness.
It's funny you say that, because I had someone say to me in an interview once, so gratitude, empathy and mindfulness didn't work then because you struggled. And I was like, I didn't really have an answer to that because I thought, I was quite taken off guard by that comment, and I didn't see it coming. And also, I'm not a good arguer, so I just went to water a bit. But that's what you're right. Like, I think it put me in a position to be strong enough to go, okay, I'm not coping.
That's what resilience is, right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. To reach out, like, it's one of the key aspects of resilience, the ability to reach out. And I absolutely reached out. And I think you're right. I'll look that person up and I'll say, hey, I just spoke to a psychologist who said that. That's a lovely observation. You were wrong.
As somebody who was very much working in the well-being space, you said it was life-changing. Like, what was it about seeing a psychologist for you that really shifted things for you? Because I think there's a lot of people who are still sort of, I say, we all sort of know in theory you should talk to a psychologist. It's a big step. And there's a lot of people who are like, well, I don't know. Am I broken enough? Like, is that really what I need? Like, so for you, Hugh, what was your experience of seeing a psychologist and how did that change things for you?
I wish I'd gone to a psychologist for my entire life, for 40 years, I turned 40 in 2020. For 40 years, I can genuinely say I've been blessed with mental health, like so blessed to be a happy 99% of the time I'm really happy. And I remember I mentioned the breakup with my ex, that I struggled for a year, maybe more with that. But I always had this default setting of being like, I was pretty happy. And when my sister was really sick, unhealthily, I kind of ignored it a bit. But I had moments where I got pretty down, but overall really, really happy. I wish I'd seen a psychologist then because a lot of the stuff we talked about had nothing to do with the fact that I was struggling in 2020 with these lockdowns and everything. It really wasn't. It was things like, oh my God, this moment blew my mind. I told her a story about how I really wanted to have kids because I wanted my dad to meet my kids. Because I remember I was playing cricket once and dad came to watch and I didn't recognize him. I remember this old guy walking around the side of the ground and then I went, oh, Jesus, that's dad. My God, he looks old. And I was 35 at the time, didn't have kids. And I went home to Penny and I said, I know our plan was to go to New York for a couple of years and work overseas. I really want to have kids. And I said, it's because I really, really want dad to meet his grandkids. I don't want him to miss out. I just felt like he looked a bit old today. And she said, that's a really good reason. And I was telling my psychologist, dad, my love for dad kept coming up a lot in the chat, mum and dad, obviously, but this love I have for dad, because she kept asking the kind of person I want to be. She was like, well, how do you want people to describe you? You know, how do you want to be described by your kids, because I was having trouble with the fact I was getting angry at my kids and I was never getting angry ever. And she said, well, how do you want to be described? And I said, oh, kind and humble. And we're talking about dad. And she said, how would you describe your dad in a couple of words? And I said, oh, kind and humble. And she said, well, isn't that interesting? Anyway, so we got into the topic of dad and I told her that story. And then we talked more and more about dad and she said, I want to know more about your dad's story. So I told her that dad was an immigrant. He came to Australia as a 12-year-old Sri Lankan boy and he was a subject of a lot of racial vilification and awful stuff. But he worked so hard. You know, he worked so, so hard through school because that's his parents came to Australia to give him the opportunity that they never had. And worked so hard through school, uni, and became a dentist and worked. He missed one day he became a dentist when he was 24, I think it was, and he missed one day sick before he was retired when he was 65. And everything he ever did, it was for us. He just wanted to give us the kids the best opportunity ever to have the opportunities that he never had as a kid. And anyway, we talked more and more about dad. And one day, Anita, my psychologist, finished the session and she said to me, you know, I think the reason you wanted to have kids was not so that, oh, I cannot say this without crying. I cannot say that crying. She said, the reason you wanted to have kids was not so that your dad can meet your grandkids. It was so your kids could meet your dad. It's you wanted them to be connected to this humble, hardworking. Because of my dad, right, my dad has placed me smack bang in the center of privilege and entitlement, and I'm very aware of that. I'm a white 40-year-old man who financially stable, who lives in a nice suburb with, you know, I've got everything. And it's because of my dad and mum's hard work. And I'm worried that my kids are not going to, you know, they'll probably go to really good schools and they'll have all these. And I've always been stressed. I'm going, oh, are they going to be spoiled? Are they going to be, they've got everything they've ever needed. And my psychologist made me realize the reason I wanted to have kids while dad was still alive was so that my kids could meet my dad, not the other way around. Stuff like that, you know. So yeah, I would never have worked that out. Right. I would never have worked that out in a million years. And when she said that to me, we was on Zoom because it's during lockdown. I just sat there. I'm not exaggerating. For 45 minutes, I couldn't move. I was just staring at the screen, going, "Oh my God, that is such a life changing realization." But we had stuff like that every single session. She'd point stuff out to me. I was bringing up stories that I hadn't told from my childhood, and they weren't deeply traumatic stories. It wasn't about trauma. And she would just connect the dots on all these things in my life that I didn't realize. And every time she would do that, the world would make, my life would make a lot more sense. That's a very long answer. Sorry.
No, it's perfect. And I still encourage anybody to go see a psychologist.
Yes, yes.
Unfortunately, again, it's not the cheapest, and we've got a long way to go in this country to make mental health care, you know, more accessible. So that we can have a whole other conversation about that. But in the meantime, we've got the gratitude, mindfulness, and empathy, which will stand you in good stead.
Totally.
But Hugh, the second book came out, Let Go, and as you said, it's all of the things that you learned that you needed to let go of. What were some of the things that you realized that you needed to let go of in order to really be, you know, the best, happiest version of yourself?
Where's the book? I have it here. So there are seven things in the book. There are seven. There are seven things in the book that I write about that I had to let go of, but there's only three on the front cover because the publisher said,
fit.
Yeah, they said, and I said, how are we going to choose? At the time, shame, expectation, and social media were the three things I most desperately needed to let go of, my addiction to social media. now they've kind of shifted a bit. But on the front cover, I'll deal with those on the front cover. Shame, and you would know much more about this than me, but my experience is that we all experience shame about something in our life. And shame basically is the thing, it's our not enough story. You know, I'm not enough of this. And so, but we don't tell anyone, we don't talk about it because we're worried. I mean, our biggest fear is we're not going to be connected to, we want to belong somewhere. And our shame is that there's a part of us that we feel like if people know more about, we will not be, we won't belong. And for me, it was just like, I just had this shame of like, I'm not good looking enough. I always felt that because I had a few experiences as a kid where I was told I was really funny looking. And I was, looking back at photos, I was a very strange looking kid. But I remember turning up to, I was 9 years old and I turned up to basketball, this new club. It was my first time ever playing basketball on a team. I was so excited. And I got to this training and there was a group of kids I didn't know. They'd all been a team for a few years. And they pissed themselves laughing at what I look like. And they called me Bugs Bunny. And they said, you've got the biggest teeth, the biggest eyes. And every time I went to say something, they'd just piss themselves laughing at me. And I didn't know I was funny looking at that point. That's the first time I, because mum would always like, you're such a beautiful boy. And I never knew I was funny looking. And I was like, it was such a shock. And I was so, I went home that night and knowing what I know now, I wish I'd told mum and dad what had happened. They would have found a way to make me not feel ashamed of it. Mm. Just like, but everyone looks different, darling. You all look different. And like some people think you're really, like we think you're really beautiful and those boys don't, but that's okay. Like, well, whatever. I don't know what they would have told me. I don't know what it was. Mum was a genius at this kind of stuff. If she'd known, she would have worked me through it and to a point where, but I just went and cried in my room for hours and didn't tell them. So I told myself a story age 9, I wasn't good looking enough. And I became really ashamed of that. And I remember being on a tram in year 9 and when a point where you're quite insecure about your looks, and I was sitting next to, there was a group of girls who went to a school, all-girls school. Actually, it was the all-girls school that I went and taught at later on in life.
Oh, wow.
And I realised they were impersonating what I look like. They were trying to impersonate my face and pissing themselves laughing. And that, I was just like, oh, God, there we go. I'm not a good-looking person. So I've always had this. I remember my first ever date I went on with Penny, my wife, and she's the most, I know everyone thinks it's about their partner, but she's like, she's just stunning. And I remember sitting there going, I'm going to have to be pretty funny here because I am not good looking enough. I am not good looking enough for Penny, this person. And so I was like, be funny, but you've got to be funny. You've got to be extremely nice because you are not good looking enough. So it wasn't until seeing my psychologist that I sort of talked all that through and then I kind of let that go, you know, like, and it linked into my, this perfection thing. I've got this, like, I just want to be perfect with everything I do and obviously with what I look like as well. And letting both those go, I was like, that's like, we all look different. I don't really care. Like, I just, and I was able to let go of that shame of what I look like. But we all have, for some people it might be, I'm not smart enough. I'm not successful enough. I'm not rich enough. But the way we deal with that is we share our shame story because shame cannot survive empathy. When you share your story, someone will give, with someone you trust or a psychologist ideally, but if you can find someone you love and someone you trust, they will break down that shame. They'll go, we build the story up so much more in our head than it really, really needs to be. So that was a big one for me.
Oh, and so again, just so relatable. And I think, you know, when you say, oh, I've got to be, you know, really on my game and be as funny as possible because I'm got to make up for this other deficit that I have. Like everybody is walking around doing that. Like everybody has got something. And I think most people, I had a conversation a while ago with Dr. Nicole LaPera. She's the holistic psychologist on, you know, Instagram. She's got 5 million followers or something.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like she's got this amazing following. She attracts a lot of critics from within the profession too, by the way.
I'm sure she would if she's got a big following. How dare she?
Well, she talks about self-healing and overcoming your trauma and all of this sort of stuff. But anyway, I remember saying to her that I had been reflecting that when we talk about being authentic, like how hard it actually is because most of us unknowingly are walking around just this walking bundle of coping strategies, you know, like we're all going through life with our masks and our performance and our, and it's a process unraveling all of that. Like it's just this layers and layers of conditioning and things like that, Hugh. Like I learned when I was 9, I wasn't good looking enough. So therefore I had to be, you know, the funny guy. Or I read in your book too, you know, like my sister's was going through the stuff. My parents were really sad. So I had to make everybody happy. Like we adopt all of these roles.
Yeah.
Unconsciously, like not knowingly, and then we live our lives being this person, which becomes so habitual and so programmed that this is just who I am.
Yeah.
When in actual fact, all it is just a thing I've been doing for so long that I don't know any different.
Yeah.
It's really just a habit. So, yeah.
But to come back to why we're talking about this, which is your excellent question, like a psychologist breaks this down for, and I remember my psychologist saying to me, and also a mentor of mine, a guy called Ben Crowe, who a lot of people heard of as Ash Barty's mindset coach, both of them have said to me, you are worthy of love as you are. You don't need to look any different. You don't need to be, you are worthy as you are. And I wish so much, I wonder if it would resonate, but I wish so much, and that's what we're starting to build into our curriculum now, this message, because I think kids need to hear at a young age, hey, as you are right now, without looking a certain way, without having a certain amount of social media followers, you are worthy of love and belonging. Don't need to do anything else. We Hamish Blake, who everyone knows, has this amazing thing he says to his kids when he puts them to bed. And I'm paraphrasing, so I might get it wrong, but he says, well, to his, I think both his kids, but he was telling me, he says to his daughter, I love you for who you are, exactly as you are. You don't need to be anything else. I love you for who you are right now. Mm. He says it to him every single night before they go to bed. And I tried to copy that unashamedly. I was like, I'm taking that. That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
Every time I try, my son goes, you tell me this every night. I know. And so it just hasn't quite worked, but it's a lovely message for people to hear at a young age.
It is. And I don't do very much clinical therapy work at the moment, but I have got a couple of one-on-one clients. Since we can do telehealth and Zoom, I've got a couple of clients. But I had that conversation with her. Like I was talking to her about, she was having difficulty with her kids and how she's trying to manage their behavior, and if they wants them to, you know, do better and be less of this and less of that. And so we had this whole conversation about when do you praise them for something other than their behavior? When do you share with them that you just enjoy their company? And it was a bit of a revelation, because I think as parents, we're just so like this, do more of this, less of that, don't do that. You know, you're so good at that, you're clever at this. But when do you just actually share with your kids? And this is a lesson for me as well. You know, just delight in their,
they
are.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I just love who you are, regardless of anything that you could do or not do, or what you did wrong or what you did right.
I'm getting a lot out of this chat. I'm just listening to you speak. I'm good with my daughter. My son's can be a bit all over the shop. He doesn't like hearing a lot of that stuff. But my daughter, who's two, I've turned her into this absolute love monster. Like I'm always telling her I love her just nonstop. And like we had a nanny, potential nanny come over. Well, she's now our nanny. She came over and met the kids for the second time. She's sitting there and my Elsie goes, I love you. I was like, I think she's really thrown around willy-nilly at the moment.
They do at that age though, right?
That's true, that's true.
Just walk up to strangers.
Like, pretty much. Out. She's not far off it, yeah.
Hugh, expectation, perfection, addiction to social media. I feel like, is there any final thoughts you want to share? Because I've just really noticed the time on this podcast.
Do you know what? It's my favourite place. The most important message I have is that we're all worthy of love as we are. So I think it's a really great place to summarize everything, because that's what it's taken me as someone who has been fascinated since the age of 20 in what is it that makes us happy, has read everything, has watched everything on the topic, has spent the last 12 years in the industry. The most important message is that we are worthy as we are of love, of affection, of belonging. We're all worthy as we are. We don't need to be or do anything else to, and we're all on this desperate, like hamster wheel or treadmill, or just to try and prove that we're worthy.
Yeah,
we are.
Totally.
We are.
I'm on this exact same page, so that is a perfect place to wrap this up. And Hugh, we'll put the links to both the books in the show notes. I just want to share too with listeners that they are both so easy to read. Like you said, they're full of just relatable stories, personal stories. Thank you for your vulnerability and sharing some deeply personal stories in the book. It is what we are desperately hungry for. And I think that connection that we get from other people's, sharing their struggles. So thank you, Hugh, and thank you for your time today.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. As I said, I'm a very big fan of what you're doing. And it was funny when the invitation first came through to be in a podcast, It's funny how the world works. I just listened to one of your episodes. I was like, shit, this is really good stuff. I need to go through the back catalogue. And I was like, oh, it's a big back catalogue as well. There's a lot here. So it was so excited to join you. So thanks for having me. And I hope I haven't rambled too much.
No. Amazing. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Hugh's two books are called The Resilience Project and his most recent is called Let Go. You can find them both at all bookstores. Also, you can find my three Crappy to Happy books in bookstores or listen on Audible for free. If you haven't already checked out my new podcast, The Confidence Coach, you can listen to that on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Please check it out and let me know what you think. And I cannot wait to catch you on the next episode of Crappy to Happy. Listener.